Welcome everybody to the Friday edition of the Damage Report, where we have Brett on. Brett always says something weird. Brett, what weird thing are you just chomping at the bit to say?
To be fair, John sometimes says something weird. Did anyone else pick up on that? When John was like, I'm gonna get Brett by making fun of the things he says, and then I'm accidentally gonna say the word says, which isn't how people say that.
I get what you're trying to do, but I'm fairly certain that all of this is exactly what I'm talking about. But anyway, welcome to the show.
You just gonna softball him in there like that? I'm having a weird, I don't know. Let's get rid of the monitors.
Okay.
How are you today, John?
I don't even know why we do video in the first place. I'm doing good. Week's almost done. It's been a big one.
Happy Good Friday.
Interesting news yesterday.
Happy Good Friday to all the Catholics and Christians out there who refer to the day their Savior died as a Good Friday. What's it gonna take to make a bad Friday,
guys? Well, they're not saying it's a great Friday. They're generally optimistic people. It's generally great. This, good.
If I loved someone, and especially if they are the reason I'm getting into heaven, I would refer to the day they died as a bad one.
I think that if you had given me an hour to speculate about how you would fill the blank of a weird thing to say attacking Good Friday, I wouldn't have come up with that. But thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Anyway, Good Friday to everybody. Anyway, we've got a lot of news we're gonna get to. We're gonna close out the show with something that's like kind of serious, but also kind of fun because of how weird it is. Ancestry.com released an ad. It's a mess, and we're gonna break that down. We've got updates on the effect of Trump's tax plan on people's take-home pay over the course of the last year. Sarah Huckabee Sanders finally admits who she is. And we've also got two awesome guests. So Rafael Moro Martins is gonna join us, writer for The Intercept in Brazil, who's gonna break down a big plan to infuse money into Venezuela if there's regime change. And that might be influencing the process to get to that. We'll be breaking that down. And in not long, Ali Breland, writer for Mother Jones, is gonna be joining us to talk about the odd support for Andrew Yang coming from the alt-right. We'll be talking about that and why it is that they've taken up Andrew Yang as a potential champion for them. But first, a little bit more on coming out of the Mueller report. After the details of the Mueller report were released yesterday, we started looking to congressional leadership. What are they gonna do based on the fact that the report says that there's not gonna be any charges over a conspiracy. And Robert Mueller, for reasons that are detailed in the report, isn't going to actually pursue any charges over obstruction of justice, even though the case is very clearly made in there. People began to wonder, well, Mueller says that it's totally within the power of Congress to do some sort of investigation or some sort of charges based on obstruction of justice. So will they do it? And so the nation looked to Steny Hoyer. And Steny Hoyer said—
One of my favorite Stennies.
He's a top five Steny. Top 10 Hoyer. Based on what we've seen to date, going forward on impeachment is not worthwhile at this point. There's an election in 18 months and the American people will make a judgment. And Nancy Pelosi said she offered a similar rationale claiming that Trump himself is, quote, not worth it. And since then I've seen a few other people, high profile Democrats, saying basically blank, 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 there's an election coming up pretty soon. Better Work said something like that. Cory Booker this morning said something similar. We're gonna have some examples of people coming from a different perspective, but what do you think about the argument that they're putting forward?
I just love the Constitution so much. I don't wanna disrespect it by not doing the thing that is constitutionally obligated for the Democrats in this situation, and the Republicans, if the shoe were on the other foot, to do, which is reluctantly but resolutely proceed on what the special counsel kind of said that they should do and is completely within their purview, which is some kind of constitutional process for, you know, acting on the conclusions made by the special counsel.
Exactly. Which again, I get that there are some people who are just never going to accept it, but I don't think that there's any way that you can read that document or even skim it like I did and look over the highlights in some depth and not come away with the idea that this guy committed obstruction of justice, if obstruction of justice is to have literally any meaning whatsoever.
Yeah, this doesn't need to be the focus of everyone's efforts. We can do a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I hate that. I hate too. So I hate what they're saying, and I'll break down why. But I hate that too, the idea that you're only allowed to talk about something that motivates 70% of all voters as the most important topic. Nobody actually holds themselves to that standard, but they do love to deploy that standard against people who are talking about something that they're not personally interested in. And as you point out, whether a president is impeached or not is not a thing where it's like, would it be cool Would it be beneficial to us politically? No, there's a standard set for certain crimes that have been committed and a consequence if they have.
And don't get me wrong, I think that the messaging going forward from the Democrats who are running for president and Congress is, isn't it just a mess? Isn't right now just such a mess? Mm-hmm. And not from the lips of the Democrats. This is from Robert Mueller.
Yeah.
This is from the person who was tasked with dispassionately appraising the president's activities. Mm-hmm. It's a real mess. Like, just for your own fun and excitement, you can look into especially the part about like Eric Prince and the Seychelles, mm-hmm. where it's an amazing read. Mm-hmm. Where Eric Prince says, I just talked to these five people and I'm about to go in with Steve Bannon and I'll see what I can do about setting up that meeting. And then the next day, books a passage to the Seychelles to go to a meeting at the Ritz, books himself into the Ritz-Carlton where Mohammed bin Salman is staying.
Yeah.
At the same time, he's going to meet with Russian oligarchs. Like,
it's Game of Thrones.
This is some John Grisham stuff.
Exactly. I prefer Game of Thrones. Except in this case, the travel makes sense because they have planes.
This is some John Snow Grisham stuff.
Okay, yes. We got to get through these graphics, though. And I will only say, in terms of the let's just adjudicate an election, that to me, I tweeted something to this effect. I can't really explain why I feel this way, but I feel like this is running our democracy by trial by combat. Mm-hmm. Trial by combat was, we're just gonna fight and God will favor whoever is right. And so if you win the fight, you're presumed to have been innocent. We don't adjudicate all crimes by just, let's see if he can make it through an election. And we sort of implicitly believe this because now any concern from before an election is erased after an election. Like for instance, Trump's tax returns. No, we already adjudicated this in election. Doesn't matter if it's a standard. He won an election, sort of. So I hate that standard and I don't think it's a good way to run a democracy. But in terms of what's actually gonna be done, there are people who are concerned about Donald Trump and what was revealed in the Mueller report, including Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who said, everything outlined in the Mueller report is further proof of what I've been saying for a long time. It's hashtag time to impeach. The first step, the House Judiciary Committee launching an investigation into whether Trump committed impeachable offenses. We also have Ilhan Omar, who said, impeachment is part of our constitutional responsibility. We have an obligation to investigate whether the president committed impeachable offenses, including obstruction of justice, violating the Emoluments Clause, collusion, and abuse of power. They were joined.
I'm exactly with that.
Exactly. And we have quite a bit of evidence for some of those. Additionally, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said Mueller's report is clear in pointing to Congress's responsibility in investigating obstruction of justice by the president. It is our job as outlined in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 5 of the US Constitution. As such, I'll be signing on to Rashida Tlaib's impeachment resolution, which is not something that she was willing to do beforehand. But now, based on what she's seen in the Mueller report, she is supportive of that. And she goes a little bit more into her way of thinking, saying, while I understand the political reality of the Senate and election considerations, upon reading this DOJ report, which explicitly names Congress in determining obstruction, I cannot see a reason for us to abdicate from our constitutionally mandated responsibility to investigate. And furthermore, many know I take no pleasure in discussions of impeachment. I didn't campaign on it and rarely talk about it unprompted. We all prefer working on our priorities, pushing Medicare for all, tackling student loans and a Green New Deal. But the report squarely puts this on our doorstep. That is a responsible answer to what we saw yesterday from one of the strongest progressives in elected government right now. Mm-hmm. It seems eminently reasonable. Those are all people in the House. Bernie Sanders, while he's not signing on necessarily to impeachment, did say, it is clear that Donald Trump wanted nothing more than to shut down the Mueller investigation. While we have more detail from today's report than before, Congress must continue its investigation into Trump's conduct and any foreign attempts to influence our election. So clearly Bernie is not done with this either. And if you read what's actually in the Mueller report, I don't see how any reasonable person who wants there to be accountability in the future for presidents could be done with this at this point.
Correct, John. 20 points.
Thank you for Gryffindor. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated
by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Over the past couple of months, presidential contender Andrew Yang has picked up quite a bit of support online, although not in all cases support that he necessarily would prefer to have. And joining us now to break down one of the weird sources of the support is writer for Mother Jones, Ali Breland. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. I enjoyed your recent piece about Andrew Yang and the weird support that he's picked up from some in the alt-right and white nationalists and, you know, various people of that sort. Before we get into what you found, though, I just wanted to make clear, because I had Andrew Yang on my show. He didn't say anything that made me think that he was supportive of any of what these sorts of people want. He's disavowed their support. So just to be clear, have you seen him say anything that, like, sort of draws a logical link to their support, or is it just that they like him and there's not much he can do about it?
Yeah, no. So to go off what you said, it doesn't seem like there's anything that he's particularly doing that, you know, makes him a white nationalist by any stretch of the imagination. But there are reasons potentially for why white nationalists have supported him and people in the alt-right and alt-right internet communities, those being the media hits that he's chosen to take. So going up on the so-called intellectual dark web, appearing on podcasts of people like Sam Harris, Joe Rogan, and eventually Tucker Carlson are all things that community really appreciates. You can see in leaked Discord chats from white nationalist communities that were uploaded online that they were rooting for him to go on Tucker Carlson. We're very pleased by this. And then also there's a set of tweets that he put out sort of nodding to injustices in the white community and the sort of plight that some white communities are facing in increased mortality rates. And so these things all within themselves seem fairly innocuous and might be, but that sort of signaling raises eyebrows a little bit and is worthy of a bit of questioning.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think that he's in a little bit of a hard position, because of course he's running as someone who's fairly unknown against many other people running this Democratic primary. If he gets a chance to go on like Joe Rogan or even someone like Tucker Carlson, who I kind of have an issue with someone appearing on Tucker Carlson considering how much he's done to amplify white nationalist propaganda. I mean, I feel like he kind of has to take that opportunity almost to have a chance of standing out.
Yeah, that's what his campaign said, for sure. And I do see the logic in that, definitely. I think that while it is understandable and my story isn't meant to be an indictment, I think that these types of things are worth critically examining at the very least, especially in concert with those specific tweets. The rhetoric of the tweets and the sort of like nod to white grievances, I think, is a little bit not normal. I don't think that we've seen that from politicians generally. And so, you know, those things are worthy of critical analysis. Certainly not indictments, but they raise eyebrows.
And as you mentioned, he has denounced this support and says that he doesn't want those people supporting him and all that. It's interesting because when I had him on my show, we talked mostly about universal basic income. That's like the core plank of his campaign. We talked a good bit about climate change and what can be done about it. So those aren't typically issues that I think of as being appealing to people on the far right. When you go into their chat rooms, you see what they're talking about. What is their explanation as to why they're interested in him?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I've spent some time in these chat rooms looking at what they're saying. And then I also in the story talked to one of the creators of the chat rooms. And their sort of rationale is that they're, I think, surprisingly ambivalent and agnostic to these sorts of quote unquote like liberal or left concerns. And they're most interested in getting a deal, like a quote unquote good deal for themselves. That's the term that they've used. And so they're very excited by things like UBI, and they're very excited about the potential for what that can do for their own lives, more so than they are about these sorts of like external concerns that wouldn't normally be perceived as conservative.
Interesting. And so I know that a lot of his support online on social media that's not coming from the alt-right and far-right, he does have a lot of like millennial followers, people who are savvy online and all of that. So for those people, how are they dealing with the fact that these forums have drawn some of the attention of people who they don't necessarily want to be associated with?
They're incredibly upset by it.
I would imagine.
A lot of backlash on my story about very concerned people who were worried about these types of associations, who wanted to make it very clear that they are not white nationalists, that they see large swaths of Andrew Yang's base who are not white nationalists, who are not bigoted, and they want to be heard from, and they don't like these types of things at all. They're not embracing it. And so I think it's frustrating for them, as it probably is frustrating for his campaign too, to have to deal with these kinds of things.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I wonder, like, so this story has come out. I've seen a few other people talking about it. I wonder what he could say or do that would cause those people to cast off from him. Like, I know, you mentioned in your piece he supports the DREAM Act and other sort of immigration measures that are not traditionally anything that conservatives are interested in. It would be interesting to speculate as to what he might say if he gets on the debate stage that would cause them to flee his campaign.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, it's interesting because he's already sort of disavowed them, but you've still seen sites like the Daily Stormer say that we're still in on this guy. So I'm very curious to understand that too. And I don't know what that point will be, because I guess there's such a rightfully underserved and underspoken to community that, you know, they're going to grasp on whatever they can. And unless someone comes out stronger, I mean, ostensibly, you could argue, you know, Donald Trump has like spoken to their issues more, but they feel as though he's not delivered. And a lot of them feel at this point that they're done with him. So I don't know, I guess, what keeps them from holding onto his leg, so to speak.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also considering the fact that, I mean, Donald Trump is already facing one primary challenger, but it's unlikely that it's going to be a really competitive or packed primary field on the Republican side. I mean, I would assume that if you're, you know, very online, there's not much really to spend your time on the right, whereas the Democratic primary is going to have a lot of different people. I wonder if there might be other efforts from the alt-right or white nationalists to sort of get involved and try to have an influence on that primary, although perhaps that's outside of the bounds of your research up until this point.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen anything on it yet. Granted, I don't spend every single day on 4chan or in Discord communities, but
you probably should not.
Yeah, my brain would be poisoned more than it is. No, it's maybe there are things catching on there, but I haven't seen them yet. The Yang thing was really interesting because as soon as you hop into these communities, it's so noticeable. The sort of aesthetic of the vaporwave meme with just the neon pink and the retro sort of like 80s flair is all over the place, or was all over the place, especially during the peak of his time online.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, Ali Berlin, thank you so much for joining us. Writer for Mother Jones writes about online disinformation and related topics, so everyone should go check it out. And thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Sarah Huckabee Sanders finally admits to a lie. We'll break that down after this. On a daily basis, Sarah Huckabee Sanders lies, but it's much rarer where she actually admits that she lies. This week, we actually got to that point. And so I'm sure she's been fired by now, right? No, of course not. But I do want to go through it. And much more interestingly, perhaps, her explanation now as to why she admitted then that she lied. So let's walk through this. First, the original lie. This is in the wake of James Comey being fired. This is the first attempt by the White House to explain sort of why he was fired or why it might have been necessary. Here is what she said right after he's fired.
Look, we've heard from countless members of the FBI that say very different things. In fact, the president will be meeting with Acting Director McCabe later today to discuss that very thing, the morale at the FBI, as well as make an offer to go directly to the FBI if he feels that that's necessary.
Okay, so James Comey at that point had lost the faith of the FBI. They all hated him. They talked about him behind his back. He didn't get invited to parties, all of that. And those people messaged Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And you're going to see a little bit more of that in just a second. But first, so that's the lie. Where's the admission? Well, in the Mueller report yesterday, we saw this. Sanders told this office that a reference to hearing from, quote, countless members of the FBI was a, quote, slip of the tongue. She also recalled that her statement in a separate press interview that rank and file FBI agents had lost confidence in Comey was a comment she made, quote, in the heat of the moment that was not founded on anything, which I think should be the postscript to her career, basically. But she admits there it wasn't founded on
theory. Exactly. Founded on nothing.
Founded on nothing. So that's out there. You know, we had the afternoon and the night where everyone's like, I mean, nobody is, let's not be stupid. Nobody's surprised that she lied. We know that she lies, but she doesn't admit to it. That's her whole job, is lying and then not admitting to it. The only reason she did in this case was she faced potentially going to jail if she lied to the Mueller investigators about it. And so in that case, she couldn't lie. So now she's on the record, but that doesn't mean that like she's not going to be able to squirm out from under it, as you'll see in this clip.
Really? Like, I mean, so are we talking
between like email, like, text messages? Like, absolutely.
50,
yes.
60, 70?
We're not going to get into a numbers game.
That's not a slip of the tongue, Sarah. That's a deliberate false statement.
Actually, if you look at what I said the slip of the tongue was in using the word countless. But there were a number of FBI, both former and current, that agreed with the president's decision. And they've continued to speak out and say that and send notice to the White House of that agreement with the president's decision. James Comey was a disgraced leaker and used authorization to spy on the Trump campaign.
I've got to stop you there because you said something else to the special counsel.
George.
Sarah, hold on a second. The special counsel writes that those comments were not founded on anything. That's what you talked to the special counsel about when you were facing criminal penalties if you didn't tell the truth, but now you're trying to walk away from it. Why can't you acknowledge that what you said then was not true?
I said that the word I used countless, and I also said if you look at what's in quotations for me, it's that. And it's that it was in the heat of the moment, meaning that it wasn't a scripted talking point. I'm sorry that I wasn't a robot like the Democrat Party.
Yeah, well, I mean, a robot might be an improvement because depending on, you know, how you apply the laws of robotics, maybe there'd be a clause but not lying in there. I don't know. So again, slip of the tongue.
Put a dollar in the nerd jar, please. Put a dollar in the nerd jar.
No, I'm not going to do that. So slip of the tongue, heat of the moment. Telling you what your heart lied?
That's
I don't know.
It should be illegal. The absolute reason it should be illegal is to, you know, use Asia's name in vain.
Yes.
The band behind Heat of the Moment. Like, so well, it sucks that immediately that's what she is.
That's what you think of.
She is colonizing your brain and making you think that awesome motivational song.
It was great.
I'm on her side in this situation because when she said countless people have approached her, she wasn't wrong. You can't count up from zero.
Mm-hmm.
Or, to put my dollar in the nerd jar, maybe it was a pre-Aztec mathematical approach where zero wasn't a concept.
It wasn't defined yet.
There was no zero.
Countless. Yeah. Yes. So the issue there, that's why she's in her position. Everything that you just saw in that, she was asked a very simple thing. Respond to this paragraph, which we've already read you. It had a slip of the tongue, that's true, but it also had, wasn't founded on anything.
She made it up.
Made it up. So instead, she said, "Well, you know, it was a heat of the moment. But ever since then, people have been saying that they didn't like Comey, and they've been messaging that." No, but that's not the lie. The lie was she said she had talked to countless people within it was about what 24, 48 hours at that point that she had received texts and emails. Not that over the course of the next 2+ years, someone would contribute to that dialogue. She said she'd received countless. When someone in the audience said, what is it, 20, 50, 60? She said, well, I don't want to get into numbers, leading you to believe that it might be 20 or 50 or 60 or at least close to that. And that was founded as it says here, wasn't founded on anything whatsoever. She just made it up because it was convenient.
But she would still cling to that concept, and that's what's so frustrating. Mm-hmm. Definitely the way that the Mueller report is written and the way that she defends herself by going into like the specific underquote of what is attributed to her as a false statement, rather than everyone just, and that's what's so frustrating with this whole process, is we can't step back enough and say, listen, this is all bad. This is all terrible. She is lying. And we're going to get into like the specifics of which words she used when just the general concepts she's furthering are utterly based on nothing. But she proceeds from the little lie and they repeat it and repeat it with different words, but the same general through line, to the point where it's so divorced from the original deviation from reality that we can't even remember what reality was.
Well, actually, well, so why don't we touch base with reality again? Because that was the reason we focus on this lie, I think, is because she lies all the time, so she doesn't admit to it. In this case, she was forced to under penalty of perjury and going to jail. By the way, that is a reminder of why Donald Trump never sat down with Robert Mueller, because he would have faced the same sort of issues. There are more important lies that she and the other press secretary told. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders lied about Trump dictating the statement about the Trump Tower meeting. She lied about when Trump decided to fire James Comey. She lied about the involvement of Sessions and Rosenstein in Comey's firing. And her predecessor, Spicer, lied about who decided to fire Michael Flynn and lied about who decided to fire James Comey. So from the inauguration to when they made that last statement, the lie that we showed you initially, effectively, we were not able to find out anything accurate about any of this because she and her predecessor were tasked with constantly lying about it.
And it's legal for her to do that. That's what's also frustrating. It is totally legal, apparently, for her to just stand in front of the press corps, speaking on behalf of the president, and lie multiple times about multiple things. There is no recourse except for public opinion, which, by the way, public opinion is against the president. Mm-hmm. So all these things they say that they've won and it's been litigated already are utterly false, because every day it's relitigated in public opinion poll after public opinion poll, which doesn't trust the president and knows that they lie.
You lost control of the House to the extent that the people can turn against you. That's in America how we represent that.
Yes.
Is losing the House, which you did.
But I want everyone to go back and look at that first video. It's Stephen Portnoy posted it on Twitter about Sarah Huckabee Sanders lying to the FBI. If you notice, when she's asked the question by the reporter originally, she has her tell. Like, her tell's there. It's a small smile. It's before any of this starts. But as he's asking her the question, she starts to like subtly smile because she knows she's about to lie.
Yeah.
So go watch that and then watch video after video of Sarah Huckabee Sanders. That's what she looks like right when she's about to lie.
And then play poker with her. Mm-hmm. Make a few bucks. Okay, let's turn quickly to another topic. Back when the Trump administration was trying to sell you on their tax plan, they gave you grand promises about how much it would benefit not only the American economy and corporations, but you individually, as an individual, and in terms of your family. So we had headlines like this: the average American family will get $4,000 from tax cuts, Trump team claims. And beyond like the actual difference in how much you'll pay in taxes, they said that this will stimulate the economy so much that we'll have more jobs and we'll also have massive bonuses. And right around that time, before it was actually passed, during that discussion, some corporations came out and said, we're going to do massive bonuses. Now, it often turned out that they had already been planning those. It had nothing to do with the tax plan. And the ones that were announced after it was passed didn't have anything to do with it. They'd been planning it for a long time.
Who gets a bonus?
Exactly.
Who gets a bonus?
Well, bonuses have become more common in recent years because the cool thing from a corporation's point of view about a bonus is that it's a one-time payment. It's not a permanent recurring addition to how much money you make.
And ask anyone who gets a bonus, they are taxed at higher rates anyway.
So exactly.
They can give you $4,000 extra dollars or pay $2,000 extra dollars in taxes.
But you seem worried. Don't worry about people getting bonuses, because apparently they didn't actually. Shocker, you were lied to. Data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics employer costs for employee compensation shows that, quote, bonuses actually fell 22 cents between December 2017 and December 2018. And the average bonus for 2018 was just one penny higher than in 2017. Now imagine if, what was that first headline we had? It's from the Washington Post, I think. Imagine if the Washington Post, average family will get 1 cent higher bonus, Trump team claims. How successful would that legislative push have been? But of course, the cool thing from the point of view of right wingers pushing tax cuts is you can lie however you want. It doesn't matter if in the end it turns out that none of your economic statements or your predictions or all of that turned out to be true. You still got the money. The corporations still got the money. The individuals still got the money. Not regular families, but extremely wealthy people that were not expecting to make one penny. They were and did make hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. They still got that. And we still paid.
So,
and wait, and just to put a little bow on it. So you had the promises, you have the harsh reality. Does that mean that the White House is going to retreat from those promises? Not at all. This came out just a couple of days ago, I believe. American workers are thriving thanks to President Donald J. Trump's middle class tax cuts. That was from the 15th. Middle class tax cuts, when over 80% of the actual benefit derived from it went to the top 1%.
I was trying to find, and I'm going to keep looking for it, just the average bonus of like a high ranking executive, I imagine swelled. I would also say that people in America aren't buying it. 50% or 49% of Americans dislike the overall dislike the overhaul compared to about 40% who approve, according to a Gallup poll. But I just think overall, like, Trump is a master marketer. He still isn't able to win the messaging when it comes to taxes because everyone has to see their own tax return. And the tax system is still so complicated. They tried to promise you that we're going to simplify it, but what that ended up doing was just getting rid of every way you could write off your taxes, essentially. So you're left to do the standard deduction. And when you do your standard deduction, you realize that you probably owe just a little more than you thought in taxes, as opposed to what happened before, which is what people knew, you would get a big tax refund. But that doesn't happen anymore. But people are still like paying their tax person, and they used to spend $300 to get $400 back. Now they're spending $300 to not really get anything back, and it's even more frustrating.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that that frustration could come back to bite them in the next election. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, more to get to. The Trump administration is pushing for regime change in Venezuela, and on the sidelines, some banks are salivating at the economic opportunities there. And joining us now to break down apparently a confidentially document plan of what one bank intends to do in Venezuela if regime change is achieved is senior contributor to The Intercept, Rafael Moreau Martin. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for having me and for having The Intercept Brazil and The Intercept.
We're always glad to have contributions from The Intercept, both traditional and Brazilian. And so you got access to some confidential documents that show a really interesting plan that the Inter-American Development Bank has apparently been cooking up. Can you reveal what was in those documents?
Yeah, it's actually a pair of documents. They are both named Venezuela Challenges and Opportunities. And the IDB is foreseeing an up to $48 billion dollars infusion of capital into Venezuela, but that is to happen only if President Nicolas Maduro is removed from office. In these documents, the IDB is outlining a four-year plan to open the Venezuela economy to foreign corporations through privatization, structural reforms, and public and private partnerships.
So they have this plan for, you know, what they intend to do if there is a change in leadership in Venezuela. But is it crazy to believe that those sorts of plans existing and being talked about are actually contributing to the chance that that regime change does actually happen?
Well, this is just guessing, but I believe that once this the plan is out, I think it's good for the opposition, Maduro's opposition, because you know they see they have all the support from you know they have the support from the U.S. and from Brazilian government as well, and now they know that there will be money coming in as soon as they get rid of Maduro. So I believe you know that having the plan for the day after Maduro is out is a great contribution to destabilize even more his regime.
Yeah, I could certainly see that. I want to learn a little bit more about both the plan and how they intended to roll it out. So in your piece, these documents were supposed to be presented at the Inter-American Development Bank's meeting in China, but that meeting was actually canceled, correct?
Yes, it was canceled. This meeting was supposed to have occurred last March, late March, in China, but President Juan Guaido, the self-titled Venezuela president, he indicated an economist called Ricardo Hausmann. He's a Mexican-born Venezuelan economist as his representative at the IDB. But as China didn't recognize Guaido's legitimacy, they didn't allow Mr. Hausmann inside the country. Then the IDB called off the meeting. For what we heard from the bank, it's set to be rescheduled at some point, but there should be a parallel event called the business meeting. It's a business forum in which big companies from every sector in infrastructure, energy, and oil, they would meet and discuss the situation in Latin America in general, but we believe that they would discuss Venezuela in particular. And this business forum is not happening anymore, according to the IDB.
Interesting. So they had a bit of a setback, but it seems like the plan is not necessarily derailed.
No, it can be. You can call that a small Chinese victory, as they still supporting Maduro's regime.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about the tone of the plan or the expectations that the IDB will be able to put it into effect. The way that they're approaching the situation is that this is not simply a plan for if it happens that there's regime change. They very much are approaching this as an it's going to happen, it's just a question of when, correct?
Yes, we heard from a source which is familiar with the IDB that inside the bank, regime change in Venezuela is not a matter of if it will happen, but when it will happen. So, and actually, Mr. Hausmann, this economist that Guaido named as his representative at the IDB, he's really familiar with the bank. He was the first chief economist for the IDB. He's been doing some work alongside with them in the past year. So we can say that they have a plan pretty much ready for when it happens, when they see it happening, like Maduro is going out of power.
And for people in the US who might not be very familiar with the IDB, what is the relationship between either America generally and the IDB? Does Trump have any connection to it? Because obviously he's one of those who's pushing most aggressively in a variety of different ways for regime change in Venezuela.
Yeah, the IDB is the Inter-American Development Bank. They support infrastructure and health and education investments in Latin America and the Caribbean. The U.S. they are the main shareholders for the IDB, which means that they have as much as 50% of the shares. Which means you can say that the U.S. is really powerful inside the IDB. We also heard from a source that this plan is being outlined by IDB, inspired by the Trump administration. We don't know if the White House directly asked the plan, or they are only inspiring the IDB to make the plan due to the aggressive posture that Trump has he's adopting with when it comes to Maduro.
Oh, well, that is fascinating, and some of the dark possibilities inherent in that. It's going to be interesting to see what else might come out in the future. And Rafael, we want to thank you again for joining us with a fascinating update on this situation.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
Anytime. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Ancestry.com with an extremely questionable ad that they've actually been forced to pull due to the negative reaction to it. We'll be showing you that and breaking it down after this. The genealogical website Ancestry.com is facing a lot of pushback against one of its ads that people had a problem with. We're going to show you the ad and watch closely and see if you can see what people had a problem with.
Abigail, we can escape to the north. There's a place we can be together across the border. Will you leave with me?
Uncover the lost chapters of your family history with Ancestry. Get started for free at Ancestry.ca.
Obviously.
Cool.
Look at that. Whoa.
Okay.
It broke the system. They've been hacked.
They're so mad about the ad. They're hitting everything.
Obviously, the problem that people had with this is a black person, a white person in love.
No.
That's is that not allowed?
No, I don't think that's
I
the issue.
I wonder if that's more have. Or less detached from reality, what I just said, than like
the ad.
Principles that guided folks toward that ad.
To make the ad. Yeah. Here's the thing. If you know nothing about history, it's like, oh, beautiful ad. Except, of course, that's not really the way it went down. It's sort of glossing over and smoothing over a whole lot of violence and rape and all of that.
That situation could have happened at some point in the past. And maybe even if it is based on what, it's just, it didn't end up
that's
like
not generally how it worked.
Most of the time.
Exactly. And so it's just, it's whitewashing. And also, like if you're gonna do an ad that is whitewashing one of the darkest periods of American history ever, perhaps the darkest period, don't also have him talk over her when she tries to say one thing. Like, she didn't get to talk. If this ad is supposed to pretend that we did not dehumanize these people, don't dehumanize them in the ad itself.
Abigail, will you come with me to the north? Because, shut up.
Wait.
Even if you don't want to come, I technically can make you.
Okay.
Because I own you, because it's
anyway,
slavery
it's just such a
times,
bad idea.
Ancestry.
Now, Ancestry has responded to criticism, pulling the ad and saying, Ancestry is committed to telling important stories from history. This ad was intended to represent one of those stories. We very much appreciate the feedback we've received and apologize for any offense that the ad may have caused.
Oh my
or
God.
Did it's cause, like, because it did.
This is what it feels like to watch Dances with Wolves. Like, it's like,
I have
like
not
a white
seen
savior.
Dances with,
it's
yes.
It just like represents an era of the 90s when people were still in that era of like, I am so tolerant and nice that I'm going to like apply my Danielle Steele's romance novel onto a period of history
I don't really understand,
but I'm only willing to understand enough of it to make myself feel good within the framework of the story I've created for it.
Yeah. So now that we've done our analysis and everything, can I reveal how much of a dork I am?
No.
So
you've been doing that.
Everybody approaches things from a different, from a particular perspective. When I saw that ad, understand, I've never used Ancestry. I don't think about Ancestry. I guess it wasn't really floating around in my mind what it is that Ancestry.com does. When I saw that ad and I see those two people in period clothing running through an empty town and then holding up a ring, I thought it was supposed to be like reminiscent of Game of Thrones or something. I did not immediately think of the American South. I thought, is this like a weird fantasy movie or something? Where are they fleeing to the north, where the dark necromancer doesn't hold sway? That's really what I was thinking of.
I'm glad.
But it turns out that as stupid as my reaction was, it wasn't as stupid as the person who made the ad. I don't think.
I love it. And it's just like, that's not a cheap ad to make, by the way.
No.
Like, that involved
shot
a lot.
Shot well?
I just threw my pen. It involved a lot of, like, there were hundreds of people involved in that.
Yeah.
And folks standing around with, like, boom mics. They had to do a lot of booking. They had to rent out a portion of Colonial Williamsburg for it.
You think that's what it was?
Or whatever, kind of.
And anyway, they took it down.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could make a lot of different ads for your Ancestry website.
Can we talk about Game of Thrones now?
Why?
I don't know.
I already weirdly made it about Game of Thrones for no reason.
That's why I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so I just wanted, well, look, so the newest one I already read, so I'm not gonna read, it's the period of the show where I go to the reviews and everything.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna make an appeal to you. If you have heard me say, please rate the podcast a lot of times, and you've always thought, I'll do it at some point. Now is that time, okay? You've got a couple of minutes. We're just gonna be like talking about Game of Thrones for a minute or whatever. You can do it. You could go on iTunes, you could bring it up, and you could click 5 stars. You could write a review. If you don't have time, fine, don't write a review. But the ratings are so important. Do you know how frustrating it is to me when I go on the news and politics section and I see new and noteworthy of podcasts that have 1/50th the ratings that we do, and they're on that and we're not. So anything you can do to help it. We have like 12, we have over 1200 ratings. There's podcasts in that section that have 40 and have a lower average rating than us, and they're noteworthy.
I don't like that.
So if you could help us, just to help me out psychologically, please go do that rating.
Yes, and update, Happy Half Hour is returning, everyone.
That's awesome.
This next coming week, we don't have a guest booked yet, but I do have a vast cache of rum.
And I assume you've probably stored up a lot of great stories to do little interstitials on.
Yes,
you're
definitely
have so much fun. You haven't gotten to make one in so long.
We're definitely going to feature Tucker Carlson's gonads.
Oh, that ad. Oh, you're going to want to see that video. It's good. It doesn't actually have his balls.
And perhaps a Jexodus ad as well to get Jews to come over to the Republican Party.
That could be a lot of fun. Also, if you're not a member, become a member, because this Sunday, Brett, me, Cenk, and Ben are reviewing Game of Thrones. You're going to want to see it. Thank you for closing out the week with me. Thank you for watching. We'll see you on Monday.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.